Okay, so yes, so we're carrying on with our series exploring Tantric Buddhism. It's been going on for quite a wee while now, but hopefully each evening stand alone as well if you're just here for the first time. And so Tantric Buddhism is, if you'd like, one of the great phases of Buddhism historically, but another way of thinking of it, well, it's also called the Vajrayana, or the Diamond Way, and it's very concerned with direct experience. And it, rather than speaking the language of concepts, what Tantric Buddhism gives to us is symbols. Yeah? So how Tantric Buddhism teaches is through symbols, and that's what we've been exploring. All sorts of different figures and symbols. So this evening is a bit of a continuation from last evening, last Monday evening, where we looked at the figure of Padmasambhava and the cremation grounds. So Padmasambhava as a figure is both a historical figure, so he's said to have been an actual person or kind of combination of people, maybe it's two or three people that have kind of been amalgamated into this one figure who brought Buddhism from India to Tibet in the 8th century. So there's that historical aspect, but also he's an archetypal figure, he's a mythical figure, a magical figure. And he's particularly associated with transformation, and particularly associated with converting demons. So whether you think of these demons as actually existing in the external world, or the demons within our own psyche, they can really feel like demons, can't they? Well, I don't know if you feel this, but I can really feel that I'm being overtaken by, you know, forces of, in my case, irritation, fury. You know, feels like, you know, really feels like this kind of demons come into me and is in charge for a while. So Padmasambhava converts these demons. So as Nyanavacha was saying last week, that's quite exciting in itself. Because it's not that in Buddhism, it's not that these forces, these so-called negative forces, are something that's thought of to be cut off or got rid of in ourselves. I remember I was brought up a Catholic, and I'm sure all Catholic priests aren't like this, but we had a very fire and brimstone priest in our parish. And I remember the priest giving a letter. It was my uncle's funeral, actually. The priest took this occasion to speak of the seven deadly sins. and he looked round and he said, "And you know why I'm talking to yous lot." And he was thumping the pulpit. He was saying, "So if you feel, if you feel lust, you've got to crush it out. If you feel like not coming to mass, you've got to crush that out." So it's very, very strong emphasis in his mind, anyway, as any forces, sort of so-called negative forces, were to be crushed out of existence. That's what I was brought up on. So I was very excited and relieved, actually excited to hear that Buddhism has a completely different notion. So in Buddhism, it says, well, all the energy, that these, this is all energy, they're all manifestations of energy, these so-called negative forces. And what we've got to do is we've got to harness that energy and convert it, as it were, to be in the service, well, of our own highest interests, in the service of the Dharma. But really what we mean by that is in the service of what's in the best interest of us and all beings. And Padmasambhava is particularly represented as the figure who converts those demons. He's not afraid of them. I think often, again, myself, I can be afraid of those forces in myself. So, and as long as I'm afraid of them, they're in control of me. You know, whereas if I could, you know, I kind of long for the day, in a way, when I can have these forces at my command. So Padmasambhava would have these forces at his command, you know, the energies he could wield, you know, and use for the good of all beings. And Padmasambhava is particularly associated with converting these demons in the cremation grounds. So we heard quite a lot about the cremation grounds last week. And there's even more to say, I think. Well, all these subjects, you know, one could spend a whole year or more talking about them. So, well, the cremation grounds as a sort of, you know, a literal place are literally that. So still, as Jnana Bhakti was saying, existing in India, when someone dies, they get burned. You know, they actually get taken to a place and put on a pyre and set on fire and burned. Or there's charnel grounds as well, where the bodies of people are left for the wild animals to get. So they're actual existing places, and the places. Well, kind of associated with, well, actually, I suppose with the people, they're probably, during the cremations, they aren't fearful places, but at night and the dark, they're probably quite fearful places. I mean, we can even feel that with graveyards in this country. They're a bit kind of, you know, during the day, they seem quite benign, but at night, you know, there's a sort of different atmosphere in a graveyard. So Padmasambhava frequents these cremation grounds. He deliberately goes there and dances with the demons and dakinis. The dakinis are usually in female form, and they represent all these energies that are sort of embodiment of energy, sort of female, wild, dancing figures. So, yeah, so I wanted to talk about more about or explore more what the cremation grounds for us can be. Yeah, so there's these literal cremation grounds, and there's literal death, but then there's a cremation ground in a symbolic way, and there's death in a symbolic way. So I thought I could say, well, actually it's really Sankarsha in this book soon, but I'll draw some things out that he says. So I'll talk for a little bit and then see if it sparks off any discussions or questions. So, yes, so the first question, when Bhante Sangharaj is talking about these dakinis, these female Buddha forms, actually, who are dancing in the cremation ground with Padmasambhava, or with any yogi or yogini who cares to go there, Sangharajita Bhante says, well, why did they go there? Why go to the cremation ground? Why is that where Padmasambhava dances? Why not go to some like beautiful garden and sing and dance there? And what he says is that the cremation ground, if you take it as a symbol, it's the crucial situation deliberately sought out. I want to come back to this deliberately sought out aspect. So it's a crucial situation, a situation where we're going to be tested, tested even to our limit, deliberately sought out. And the dakinis, these female embodiments of energy, of enlightened energy, are the energies that rise once you're in that crucial situation. And actually, and I think this is really interesting, Bhante says they can't arise anywhere else. Those energies can only arise in a crucial situation. I think that's really interesting, actually, that I've come across this again and again in my Dharma life, that it's only, you know, I kind of, in a sense, I think I'm getting along fine, but it's only when I test myself, but even in a crucial situation, even makes it sound too grandiose, maybe just taking a little risk, that I uncover parts of myself that I didn't even know about yet. And often they're in a kind of quite a raw, even quite a sort of seemingly negative form, like doubt or fear or something like that, but it's only by putting myself in this situation that they're tested. If you're just kind of going along, you know, da-da-da, a cup of tea, a little meditation here and there, you won't be tested like that, and these energies won't get a chance to sort of come into the light of day. So the Dakinis are energies that arise, they can't arise anywhere than in the cremation ground. And what Bhante draws out is that the implication of this, he says in very simple terms, is that we're capable of far more than we usually think. Yeah? He says that rather than finding the energy and then using it to do the job, as it were, we can take up the job knowing that the energy will come. So we start to learn to have faith in that. Yeah. So if we start to build faith in this, then we can sort of plunge into the crucial situation, knowing that something will come up to meet that. Yeah. We can learn to trust that. And he says that when we've learned to trust that, we can take our seat on the cremation ground, knowing that the Dakinis, these positive forces, will gather round. But that takes tremendous courage and confidence, yeah? Tremendous courage and confidence. But this is what Padmasambhava did, and this is what we have to do if we want to be like Padmasambhava or those tantric yogis and yoginis. That's where the follower of the tantric path would live. You know, you'd be just looking out for that every moment and every day, yeah? And you'd live in that cremation ground with everything that implies. And from the tantric point of view, that's what the dharmic life is. You know, that's what it is. It's like looking for those situations and putting yourself in them. Yeah. And we had a description last week of Padmasambhava. We had a picture of him on the shrine. And he, in the picture on the shrine, and Jnanavacha described it, he's got this very quite fancy kind of crown. He's got these three robes, a simple robe, but then some more sort of glamorous ornate robes on the outside. And you know, he's sitting half in meditation with one foot stepping down, holding a staff. But that's not, when he's in the cremation ground, that's not what he looks like. So I'll tell you what he looks like when he's in the cremation ground. He's depicted in what is called his Heruka form as a naked yogi seated on a carpet of human skin on a pile of human bones, and on all sides are dead bodies and blazing funeral pyres. And then in one hand he rattles one of his little damaru drums. That's a symbol of fearlessness. And from the other, he drinks from the skull cup. We had the skull cup full of the Amrita, kind of blood-like nectar. So that's what he's like. So you kind of go into this cremation ground naked, really. In a way, you've sort of got to, really. What could this mean for us? What could this mean for us? And particularly, I want to go back to this thing about the cremation ground is somewhere that's deliberately sought out. And I think that what we're doing when we deliberately seek out a cremation ground is we're very actively looking for situations that are bound to give rise to fear, but deliberately to go towards that in order to overcome it rather than to give in to it. That's the way, according to Tantric Buddhism, to become completely fearless, yeah? Because you do exactly what you and everyone else is afraid of. These tantric yoginis and yogis would go to the cremation ground at night, you know, when there's no moon. It's completely dark. Yeah? So this is This I'll spend a lot of time on this quality of fearlessness, because I think sometimes it gets missed out when we're thinking about the qualities of the Buddha and the quality of the enlightened mind. As a matter of fact, we emphasise it quite a lot here at the centre, precisely because it can sometimes get missed out. Often when we think of the qualities of the enlightened mind, we think of the more, maybe even more sort of, I hesitate to say passive, but perhaps more gentle qualities, such as, you know, love, compassion, patience, tolerance, you know. Great deal's made of that these days, isn't it? Sort of tolerance, not kind of non-judgmental, you know, all that kind of, you know, that's very, very much is made of that. But according to Buddhism, the kind of more active, if for want of a better word, more heroic kind of qualities are just as important. So courage, self-reliance, self-confidence, initiative and energy. They're also qualities of the enlightened mind. They're also qualities of the Buddha. You need that. I mean, you know, you're just going to need that. There's such a journey ahead of us, you know, and there'll be so many things kind of thrown up to us that we're going to need those qualities. You might have seen depictions of the Buddha. We've got one in our small shrine room here, with his hand held up in a gesture of fearlessness. It's the Abhaya Mudra, it's called, the gesture of fearlessness. And in its kind of fullest form, and for an enlightened being, they would see that there actually is nothing to fear. That would be the insight that goes with enlightenment. There's nothing to fear because there's nothing to protect. That's what the Buddha would have realised, that there's nothing to fear. If we're not the Buddha, if we're not enlightened, then we're going to have to practice. Fearlessness is going to be something more to practice than something that we've realised. So this practice of going into the cremation ground, as it were, is something that we can actively do. And it's not just fear as well. If you think of those places, those actual cremation grounds, there'd be a very strong element of loneliness there. Yeah, very strong element of loneliness. These yogis and yoginis would be going on their own. That would be part of it. So again, if you just imagine, even in an ordinary graveyard, you know, being there at night, there's no moon, on your own. A sort of in this kind of place with like death all around, you know, so perhaps even a foreshadowing of your own death, perhaps, you know, just that realization of one day it'll be me, you know, in the ground here. And what Bhante says, he says, in the cremation ground, you can take nothing for granted, not even your own reason. For in the cremation ground, you finally come face to face with yourself, with your weaknesses and your strengths, with who and what you are. And this is never a comfortable thing for the mind. And again, he emphasises that you're doing this, you're choosing to enter, yeah? You're doing it deliberately. You don't just wait for death to come to you. I mean, death will come to us, our own death and the death of loved ones and so on. But you don't just wait for death to comfort to us. You go looking for death. It's like you're seeking out fear. It's like you're saying to sort of those forces in the universe, look, I'm ready for you. Come and do your worst. Like, you know, I'm ready for you, yeah? So what it's representing is a time of crisis that you deliberately plunge yourself. So a time of crisis in itself isn't a cremation ground. It might be, but it's not. You can't just say that it definitely is, because it's going to depend on how you meet that, yeah? I think that's quite an important distinction to make, actually. It's a bit, yeah, I was thinking it's a bit like the truth of dukkha or suffering. Understanding that truth isn't just simply mean that you have suffered. You know, it's not just that you experience something. It's that you, it's how you meet it, how you face it. So it's a situation of crisis that you deliberately put yourself, even plunge yourself, in which your Bandhi says you're compelled to change. You've got, Bandhi says you've got to develop or die. Yeah? So you're deliberately seeking out what other people avoid, but actually what you yourself want to avoid. And that's why it's a symbol of transformation. Yeah, it's going to transform your whole being from its heights to its depths. It's going to transform the bits that you don't know about yet. When you're not in the cremation ground, you know, you can sort of get away with it. If you just do things that are easy for you all the time, actually no transformation can happen. That's going to be different for every person, you know. One person's cremation ground is another person's, I don't know, swing park, you know. So it is an individual thing. I remember being... sort of cremation ground experience I was on, as I took part, some of you might have done this, I think, one of the institutions of our movement is carrying a fundraising for mostly for people in India, very underprivileged people in India. And this fundraising is done by going around the streets of cities and knocking the doors of strangers and asking them to give money to this charity. It's terrifying, isn't it? I mean, honestly, it's exhilarating as well, but you're standing on that doorstep, literally not knowing who's on the other side and what sort of reception you're going to get. And you're standing there, you're hoping they're not in, you're knocking the door, you're going, oh, please, don't let them be in. And that's one of the first things you learn, is to actually knock the door loudly enough. Because you're so, you know, you knock the door really quietly, and you think, oh, good, you know, but you've got to knock the door loudly. But interestingly enough, I remember someone said, one of the trainers, some people are more naturally good at it than others, but he was really pointing out that the person who raised the most money wasn't necessarily the one who had undergone the most self-transformation by doing this practice. I mean, raising the money is good from the point of view of the people in India, but from the point of the self-transformation, you know, maybe the person who dares to climb up to the top step and just knock the door, that in itself can be the transforming aspect. It's funny, and I might as well do a little advert for these appeals while I'm on it. I tell lots of people I did this, and loads of people say, oh no, I couldn't do that because I hate asking people for money. As if there's this sort of breed of people who love asking people. You know, the point is, everybody hates it, you know. That's why you sort of do, that's the aspect of it being self-transforming. That was me just illustrating that it might not necessarily be the outward result that shows the degree of transformation. So in that case of the carrier, because it wasn't necessarily the person who made the most money who'd undergone the most transformation. You know, if someone's, I don't know, terrified of the dark, you know, maybe just to step into that just for a few minutes it requires more courage than, you know, someone who's very comfortable in that zone. What Bhante is encouraging us to do is really look for chances where we can experience our own cremation grounds in the course of our ordinary lives, yeah? So he gives a few examples. He says, when an important deal falls through at the last minute. So I think that's quite a good example, because it's something that you're very, very emotionally involved in. It's something that you really maybe cared about and worked for maybe years, and then all goes wrong at the last minute. How do you face that? Again, that in itself is how you face that will that will make a, you know, whether it's a real cremation ground or not, yeah? And then, well, of course, there's the, if someone you love dies, very, very moving. Like last week, some people shared with us their experience of death in loved ones. And what was very interesting to me hearing people, and which resonated with my own experience, was it's never what you think it's going to be. I remember experiencing this very strongly when my dad died. I had looked sort of towards that event. You know, I'd always kind of dreaded this event and thought, oh, this will just be the end of my world. I'll never smile again. I'll just never be able to manage somehow. And then he did die quite suddenly, and it was like very sad, and I did smile again, actually quite soon. I found myself smiling, you know. And what I realised is, when I'm imagining that dreaded event, it's very, very two-dimensional in my imagination. But when it actually comes, it's a much, much more rich experience with many more facets. Yes, there's grief and sadness, but there's also love and connection. There's just so much more to it. And what's more, like, I'm a different person because I've now gone through the experience. It's quite hard to put that into words, isn't it? But I imagine you might know what I mean. When you're projecting forwards, you think it's you as you are now, and this thing is going to happen to you and it's going to be terrible. But actually, when you get to it, and when it happens, well, life's dynamic, isn't it? So it then has an effect on you, and you're transformed by it in some way, so it is different. So yes, I was very struck by that in other people's experience and my own, that something, even something quite dreaded, in the getting to it, it can be different, and it can even have positivity in it that you could never have imagined beforehand. Similarly with one, I'm lucky enough to have very, so far, good health in my life, but even, you know, I imagine the experience of suddenly finding yourself in ill health as a very, well, that's a crucial situation, that's something that you're going to have to, you know, well, either transform or die in a sense, you know, even if not literally die. And then there can be another example that Sankaracharya gives is, well, it's to do with self-confidence, the arena of self-confidence. And again, Bhante says here it isn't so much the lack of confidence itself or the objective situation calling for confidence. And he gives the example of speaking in public, which apparently is one of the number one fears, actually. Some people are more afraid of that than death, apparently. So it's not that, but it's not, I quite like it myself. It's not the objective situation itself that's a crucial situation. So the crucial situation is when you're forced to confront your lack of self-confidence. So that's, do you see the distinction? So it's not the lack of self-confidence itself or the situation itself, it's that. It's when it's the confrontation, yeah? And, he elaborates on that example because he says, well, if that is your fear, and I've got other different ones, you know, you do everything you can to avoid having to do it, but then like something happens and you've got to do it, and you agree to do it, even against your own better judgment. And then he said, when the day comes, you're quite likely to think, I just can't do it. And he says, you can either conveniently fall ill or face up to the fact that your self-image was an illusion. And he says, that's the crucial situation. He says, if you can confront your fear of failure and take the risk of going on to give the talk, then that's a further cremation ground. And I was thinking of, I think the time where I've been most tempted to back out of something because of fear was a number of years ago. I used to, I kind of got involved with Buddhism here at the London Centre, and then a couple of years after I got ordained, I was in my early 30s, and there was a need basically for some more order members, especially women order members, to go to Dublin. I mean, it's not really very far away, it's only across the water. And I kind of thought, well, I must go. I can't ignore this need, you know, I must go. And then as the time came nearer, I just got more and more not wanting to go. I so didn't want to go. I thought, oh no, I'm going to like Liz and my friends. I just started a new relationship. I thought, well, the relationship will probably break up. I had a dream where I was about to stab myself with this big knife, you know. And I remember thinking that it is a kind of suicide in a way to do this, but if I'm perfectly happy here, you know, why am I going? I really, really didn't want to go. And I do remember that I thought, maybe if I got really ill, I wouldn't have to go. Oh, that'd be a good idea. And then I remember thinking, it's a bit messy. You don't, look, if you don't want to go, don't go. That's a bit stupid to think of getting ill in order to go. If you don't want to go, don't go. But don't not go because you're frightened to go. Don't let that be a reason. I remember feeling that really strongly. Like, how would you be able to, in the future, live with yourself? If you haven't gone because of fear, like, what are you going to say to yourself in the future? So it was felt important to give myself the choice. I thought, if there's a rational reason not to go, you can make that a rational choice, but don't not go because of fear, you know. And so I did go, and you know, I wasn't really ready to go. I mean, I'm embarrassed to think of how I tried to like teach the classes and stuff there. I wasn't really ready to go, but who else was going to do it? And in a way, I learned in the doing of it, you know, and that was what, I remember the person who'd invited me to go, a more senior order member than myself, he said, don't wait till you're ready to come or you'll never come. I always remember that as a very strong teaching. He said, if you wait till you're ready, you'll never be ready. And he was saying it, you know, he was saying it generally of all of us. He said, you've just got to do it and you just get ready on the doing it, even though, you know, in many ways, you know, I mess things up and stuff, but I sort of cobble my way through it. And very, very, very glad for the experience of going in many ways. It was like extremely growthful. It was the kind of thing you look back as well and you think, oh, if I'd known what it was going on for, I'd never have done that. But somehow you've done it. So I think that kind of... that responding to objective need is a way that we can, well, it's a kind of, it's a doubly good thing, because one, the objective need gets met, but also I think for our personal selves, personally that's why I found one of the most growthful things in my Dharma life, is to just try and do what I'm asked in a way, even if I think I can't possibly do this, I'm not up to it. So far seem to have found a way, you know, very imperfectly, but, you know, you do it, and then you realise, well, just like Bandy says, actually, there is more to you than you actually thought there was. You can rise to it. So I think that's, maybe if I'm speaking a little bit personally here, that's one way where I've kind of consciously tried to sort of seek out those cremation grounds in my Dharma life. And another way, and I'm quite glad to have the opportunity to talk about this a little bit, is solitary retreats, I thought of. Nyanavacha, as ever, was announcing our retreats and the tea break. So, I mean, to go on retreat, especially for the first time, I think is, again, putting oneself in a crucial situation. I think solitary retreats, I was just glad to speak, because we don't really talk about them so much, but... some of you might have done a solitary retreat. I know, looking around, a good few of you have. So solitary retreats are something that's been very important to me, and I know many other order members and mitras in our Dharma life. And the basics of a solitary retreat is it's a retreat you go on your own. So that's the kind of basic, that's the kind of definition of it. You go on retreat and you go on your own. Different people will do that in different ways, and different people will be in possibly a crucial situation in different ways. So some people, when they go on solitary and they're on their own, is a time where they experience fear very intensely. There's a lot of mad axemen apparently roam around caravans in the hills of Scotland and so on. So some people get a lot of fear on solitary retreats. So I don't experience fear on solitary retreats. I don't experience loneliness either so much. I really usually enjoy solitary retreats. But I still think it's a crucial situation because I just experience myself and my kind of boring-ish habits, really. I'll say a little bit about how I do a solitary retreat, in case you're ever thinking of it. There's different ways of doing it. I really like to go to fairly remote places. My favourite thing is to go on a solitary and not sort of leave the vicinity. So I make sure I do all my shopping and everything beforehand. So I'm not going to encounter anyone at all when I'm there. And I don't often stray far. If I'm in a little hut or caravan, I often don't stray far from it because I get this sort of sense of a magic circle on solitary retreats, that you kind of create this, kind of realm of grace that you can dwell within. I enjoy that very much, and I love... The other brilliant thing about not meeting anyone is you don't have to wash your hair or anything like that, which I love. I really, really love not having to be presentable, you know. I can barely manage it at the best of times, but I really love not having to... I think so much of us is concerned about, well, how we look. You know, some people even put on their makeup just to go out to post a letter or something. You know, there's that kind of expectation to... be properly attired and properly, you know, and I love just not having to bother about that at all, that no one's going to see me. I remember once when I was in a place, some Jehovah's Witnesses came to the door. I think they got more of a fright than me, because I was all covered. I don't know, I was in this place where you had to light the fire, and somehow I'd got ash all over me. I don't know why. Anyway, they turned around, looked at me, and ran to the hills. So I like there being a small element of, I mean, it's too grandiose to call it ordeal together, but the place I've most recently been going to is a very remote place in Scotland where you have to walk the last couple of miles, and if you've got all your food for 3 weeks, that's a fairly heavy rucksack. I like that, actually. I like that it's not easy. You know, I like that there's a little bit of adventure to get there in some sense. So if I've had to work a bit hard to get here, that is just personal to me, but somehow... I like that, and then I ensconce. Other people might do it quite a different way, and then when you get there, well, it's going to be up to you whether you decide to adopt a kind of fairly sort of a programme that maybe you borrowed from other retreats you've been on, with periods of meditation and Dharma study, yoga or reading or doing nothing. I think doing nothing is very, very important on solitary retreats. It's often the only chance we get to that. Or some people might have a more fluid program where you just see what emerges in that moment. I remember on one whole solitary retreat, I put my clock away completely, just allowed myself to wake up when I woke up, go to sleep when I was tired, eat when I was hungry. I really wanted to just get away from that clock time. It was quite interesting because I noticed that I sort of started to devise new ways of telling the time. Obviously the sun was one, and then I used to notice that I measured the time by sticks of incense. So I'd say, oh good, aren't I good, I meditated for a whole stick of incense length of meditation. So that was quite interesting. That was what I mean by the more boring habit. You know, no one even cares, you know, how long it's a better magic meditation. No one's ever going to know, but that's the most thing that I confront on solitary. It's that little voice that's going, you didn't meditate long enough, you meditated too much, you got up too late, too early, you know, that kind of little inner critic, I suppose, voice that's obviously mine because there's no one else there, you know, as if I'm going to have to give some account to myself. So it's quite interesting. It's not so dramatic as feeling terror or terrible loneliness, but it's still, there is a sense of having to face something in myself that in my life at large I just blame it on other people probably, you know, whereas on yourself you're faced with, no, that is me, that is not any other person that's criticising me in that way. I must say I recommend solitary retreats very, very highly. I've been going on solitary retreat every year, I would say, for the last about 27 years or something. Starting off, I think I started with about 3 days, and the longest one I've done is a month. I know people have done much longer, but you know, I recommend starting off with a few days and then just building it up. It's very, very, it's a very important practice, as well as can be very, very delightful, actually. Very, very, I felt very, very happy in a very, like, childlike way on solitary retreats, but also a very, very good way for just coming face to face with yourself, yeah? So that can be a cremation ground. It's not necessarily, interesting enough, Bhante says this, he says the tantric cremation ground is essentially an inner experience. And he said being alone is not in itself a crucial situation. He says fear might arise when you're alone, but this may be because you don't have company to distract you from the fear that's always there. And he says in other circumstances it may be the very presence of someone else that gives rise to the crucial situation, like in the case of hatred or jealousy. Yeah, when I read that, I was really reminded of reading years ago the account of Brian Keenan, and you know, he wrote An Evil Cradle, and some of you might have read it, when he was held hostage in Beirut. Very good account of, I think, someone. I think he faced the crucial situation in many, many ways. I haven't read it for a long time, but some of the things I remember are, at one point, he was alone in this cell, and at one point he just heard this music. He never to this day knew whether it was real music that they were playing very, very loud to kind of torture him, or it was music in his own head. But he just thought, this is going to drive me mad. It's going to drive me mad. And he was really, really feared that he would lose his mind. And then he thought the only thing to do, this is very moving actually, he said the only thing to do was to start dancing. And he just started dancing to the music. So very Darkany like, I think. So that was a move. I think that was moving towards it. You've got the thing, I guess that's what Bhante means in itself. It's, if you go mad, then it hasn't been the crucial situation in this sense, you know. But if you face it, it's the thing itself and the way you face it, then that was a transformation. So he just ecstatically danced, you know, and then he didn't go mad and he wasn't afraid of this anymore. And then he was, he had to absolutely confront the fear of loneliness. You know, there he was, like, on his own with his captors, you know. But on his own for, I don't know, like months in the dark, you know, they just used to turn the light out and it would be pitch black for ages. And then one day the door opens and, like, we throw someone else in, John McCarthy, wasn't it? And he realises that's even worse, you know. He's been frightened of being alone, but now he's going to have to share this tiny cell with someone else. And he writes very openly about that the fear of intimacy is even stronger. And I mean, they have to live, you know, they have to just everything, you know, they're just in there together. So I thought that was, I really remembered that actually, that we can be frightened of being alone, but we can also be frightened of other people. Just as strong, whether it's fear of, you know, there's these more kind of, well, the ones Banti talks about are like hatred and jealousy, but I think that fear of intimacy can be even stronger in a way. So these are fears, and it's interesting, Banti says again, if we feel that fear in relation to another person, let's say we feel jealousy, you know, Banti says, well, it can be so strong that we feel like even like murdering someone in the case of sexual jealousy, say. Banti says how we should respond to it is we should just say, aha, this is a crucial situation. I'm approaching the cremation ground, the place where my ego could die. And I really, I think that's quite a radical approach because it's a very, very unpsychological approach, isn't it? It's not, Banti isn't even saying we should do the metta-bhavana for that person. I'm sure that's good as well, but he's actually saying, meet it head on and go like, when we're feeling something as strong as jealousy or hatred or terror of intimacy, what we're feeling very strongly is me. You know, we're feeling that very strongly is me. So that's why it's a crucial session. If we could see, if we could sort of find a way of facing that, you know, then there is a potential for freedom in that. Because as long as we think there's an I that's got to be protected, we will feel fear. They're like both sides of the same coin, aren't they? As long as there's an I to be protected, we will feel fear. But if we can face that, we can start to attenuate that sense of the meanness that has to be protected. So that's a few, that's a sort of whirlwind tour of the kind of cremation around per se, but where we might meet that in our own lives. So we might meet that through our own illness or the or death of a loved one. We might meet it through more everyday situations, like being called upon to do something we're afraid of. And what I'm saying is we can actively look for those situations. So if we are afraid of something like public speaking, we could look for, well, where is that needed? You know, we could take it on to just respond to when that was needed. If we're afraid to go on a retreat or a solitary retreat, we could kind of think, oh, I could just stretch myself a bit here. And not, maybe the important thing to say is not, when the fear arises, that's not a bad thing. Ah, this is the most important. That's a good thing. Because I think, don't take that as a bad sign. Take that as a good sign. Because that shows that we're doing something that has taken ourselves beyond our limit. So actually, when the fear comes, we think, aha, I know you. I know why you've come. You've come because I am taking a step forward in my Dharma life. I'm ready for you. You see, so in that way, we're sort of embracing it as a positive thing rather than being afraid of the fear itself. I think that's a mistake we can easily make in our Dharma lives. We think if we feel something so-called negative, like fear, we've done something wrong, but actually more likely it means we've done something right. So maybe I'll pause there. There's about 10 minutes left. I've said hundreds of things, but I don't know if anything's been stimulated. Yes?
I just wanted to add to something what you were saying. The concept of discipline. You don't just walk into the cremation ground with no discipline, with no understanding, with no grounding. You really prepare yourself. When I was in Bodh Gaya, I was very impressed with this older member, Buddha Vajra, who said to me, I'm going to meditate in a jungle. Yes. Not because he goes on his own in a jungle, but because he goes in his own jungle and knows how to handle it. He lives in a place where snakes walk around, and they don't kill the snakes because they're Buddhist. The snakes are poisonous, but he knows how to handle the snakes. And he said he found the best meditation when he goes in a jungle is to lie down and meditate with the snake dangling down from the ceiling, because that way, you know, you really have to work on yourself, because if you move, the snake will bite you, and you don't have anybody that can help you. You're dead, basically. Yeah. So, these are the sort of things all the Indian order members do, I guess, but we don't get ourselves in that.
I think that's interesting, both of us. It's interesting, isn't it, that we both have to prepare ourselves, and we can't fully. So, what I'm saying about solitary retreats, I said, so in one way we can prepare ourselves, so I wouldn't suggest doing a 6 month or even 1 month or even 2 week solitary retreat first off. I suggest starting gradually, so in a sense there is a preparation. But in a way, nothing can prepare us as well, or it wouldn't be a cremation. I think that's where we've got to use our intelligence. And again, we can translate, can't we? So we might not literally be having a snake dangling down, but for some people, maybe giving a Dharma talk would feel as crucial. They'd rather have that snake dangling down, you know, actually. It would feel as crucial. So I think we can look in our order, or having a difficult conversation with someone, you know. I think, again, that other people one, you know, very, very often that can be our biggest fear. You know, there's something we really know we have to or even need to say to someone, and we're frightened. You know, we're frightened of conflict, or we're frightened of intimacy. How do we, you know, so that, in a sense, is a crucial situation, is not just... You know, that's when all the excuses come in, isn't it? We think, oh, it's not the right time. I won't say it now because, I don't know, they're just about to go to sleep. Or, but I won't say it now because they've just woken up. But I won't say it now because they're not in a very good mood. And I'm not saying it now because they are in a good mood and they don't want to. And then we just kind of go through this literally. So I think, in a way, I think, yes, there might be a literal snake, but there's these metaphorical snakes down my bed. Don't know, it's probably time for if there's one more question. Yes, Paul.
If, for instance, I'm really scared of buses, right?
I've been hit by a bus.
How might I benefit by going standing in the middle of our brother?
Ah, well, there's rational fear. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because some fears are reasonable, aren't they? Yeah, so some fear is there to protect, so that wouldn't benefit you, yeah. I wouldn't recommend it.
Is it about taking risks, but not too much, kind of? Because that's what, in terms of physical risk.
Well, I mean, it's not taking foolhardy risks either, you know. So you wouldn't, would there be no spiritual benefit to putting your life and limb in danger just for the sake of, I don't know, like a thrill, or for the sake of, you're kind of using your intention. What you're doing with the cremate, what you're doing is you're trying to call up these forces so that they can be transformed in yourself. So it might be that it might not even be the degree of risk, it's you've got to sort of know why you're doing it. You're going into this consciously, you know. You might be taking a conscious risk, yeah?
But if your fear is dying, if you have fear of dying, in the way...
Well, that won't be... In a way, that's going to happen anyway, isn't it? Yeah. So you wouldn't... it wouldn't help to sort of... I'm just trying to think of a better way to say this. What should I say to this Jnanavacha? You don't confront your fear of dying by putting yourself in a situation that threatens your life. And interesting enough, Sangharaja said that all fear is fear of death. So you confront your fear of dying by, you know, maybe, like I think, like for some people probably going on a solitary retreat is confronting their fear of dying. Because it's probably not going to be a literal risk of death, any more than usual. But what you're trying to do is transform something within yourself so that you will be able to meet your death with less fear. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So in a sense, it might be that you take a gradual, you know, path of regular steps. But you might not know in advance, you know, it's quite, you might not know in advance what's going to provide the crucial situation. Sometimes you don't know until you're in it. But yeah, I mean, generally speaking, you might, I mean, the solitary retreat one's quite a good example, isn't it? To, you know, try a short one, then a bit long, and see how you go, you know. Or if you're terrified of giving a public talk, don't make your first one, you know, one in front of 500 people or something like that. Or prepare well for it, you know. It doesn't mean just sort of throwing yourself in a foolhardy way into situations, but just seeing how can I go beyond the limit of this, and then see what it's like, because what you do is you gather shraddha that actually something comes into being, yeah. So yeah, and maybe and friends can help as well, although sometimes friends are a bit too cautious, I think, as well. I think we could sometimes encourage each other to take more risks, you know. We often say, like, take care, don't we? You know, sometimes I think we can encourage each other to take a risk. Because sometimes, for me, it's been my friends believing in me that's made me know I could do something. You know, sometimes I've literally thought I can't do this, but my friend thinks I can, so I'll do it, yeah. Okay, I think we're going to have to leave it there. So there'll be more tantric symbols next week. So, hope you can all come back then. Great, thank you.